Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It certainly is a pleasure to be here with you. And first, I would like to express my gratitude to you for inviting me over. I always feel very happy whenever I have the privilege of coming to visit with, I call all of you my friends, wherever you are. We all seem to know exactly why we're here. We are here because we speak one another's language. We understand one another. It is a language that, regardless who the person is, unless they are really and truly one of us, they just simply don't seem to understand. To bring out my point, it brings to my mind a story of a little boy that I heard about that lived on the opposite side of the track with his mother. And he was quite poor, and he was very incorrigible. And his mother was going to take him downtown one day, and she said to him, "Now, son, please don't ask for anything. I don't have any money." Well, immediately when he got downtown, he, in the large department store, in the children's department, he fell madly in love with a little wagon. And when he sat in it, he didn't want to get out of it. The longer he sat, the less he thought of getting out of it. So his mother said, "Now, son, you'll have to get out of it. I told you I can't buy it." Oh, he got very belligerent and he sat right there. So the store manager came over and he said, "Oh, madam, don't be alarmed. I can get him out of the wagon." He said, "We have a wonderful child psychiatrist here that understands children and he can get him out." So the psychiatrist came over, pardon me if there are any psychiatrists in the audience, and he handed the child such gibberish as a psychiatrist can hand one. It meant nothing. He simply sat right there. So the store manager came over and he says, "Now, don't be alarmed, madam." He said, "We have a physician here, and he's a children's physician. He understands children, and he can get him out." So the physician came over and he said, "Now, young man, that wagon has been sprayed with a deadly chemical. And if you don't get out of it, you'll become poisoned and you'll die." It meant the same to him. He still sat right there. So in the meantime, a clergyman walked over. He saw the commotion and he said, "Now, I have a wonderful Sunday school class and I understand children. I can get him out." So, of course, they let him try. And the clergyman said, "Now, son, if you don't get out of that wagon, you're going to die and the bad man will get you." That didn't mean a thing to him. He sat right there, and his poor dear mother, she's still crying and praying all at the same time. And in the meantime, a lowly janitor was on the floor. And he, seeing the commotion, came over, and he said to the store manager, "I know that youngster. I can get him out. I live on the same street he does, and I speak his language." Oh, they thought, now here are three men of letter, and they can't simply make him move. Now, what can a lowly, illiterate janitor do? But time was being wasted, so they let him try. So he leaned over the child, and he whispered something in his ear, and immediately the child took his mother by the hand and went quietly out of the store. So the store manager said to the janitor, "How did you do it?" He said, "I know him. I speak his language." He said, "Well, please tell me what you said." He says, "Well, I'll tell you exactly what I said." He said, "I told him, if you don't get the hell out of that wagon, I'll break every damn bone in your body." But nevertheless, evidently the child must not have been an alcoholic. You know, we alcoholics can't stand harsh language, you know that. So that is for sure. So. And many times, even today, sometimes when I think of my conversation with the non-alcoholic, I am still on the defensive. I still am saying the wrong thing or wondering whether I'm saying the wrong thing. I spend so much time with my people. I can remember not too long ago I was coming down the street and I ran into a very elderly lady and she had two large packages in her hand and of groceries. So my being much younger than she, I took one of them for her and I helped her to the porch. And when she got there, she said, "Oh, thank you, darling." She says, "I hope I run into you someday when you're loaded." I said, "No, you don't, madam." So, you see, really, my conversation now isn't too much. where the non-alcoholic is concerned, because generally I'm always thinking, you know, I'm still self-centered. I'm always thinking about me and my problem, and it's well that I do. I don't have to go around telling people each and every day I'm an alcoholic, beware, I might bite, but I have to tell myself each and every day, Holly, you are an alcoholic. I must constantly remind myself of that, and that is one of the privileges that has been granted to me to be here today. Well, I say a privilege to come here, and it certainly is. Now, I met on my road to Jericho these three same off-tour gentlemen that I spoke of a while back, the minister and the doctor and the psychiatrist. But their answer to me was a little different. The minister told me where I wasn't going to go. The psychiatrist told me where I needed to go, and due to the inadequacy of my purse, the doctor told me exactly where I could go. But now let's examine that. Is there any reason today why I should feel so terribly put out, shall I say, about it? No, my friends, there is not. Because I have learned since being into this wonderful fellowship of ours that AA was designed for the alcoholic. There's no minister in the world that says, I'm a minister only for alcoholics. There's no church in the world that says, this is a church just for alcoholics only, as I know it. Now, it could be, because I don't know very much. But nevertheless, I have learned this. If I cut my leg very badly, or shall I say, I broke it in some place, and the blood was flowing out of it, the first thing when I got to the physician's office, or shall I say to the hospital, that the doctor would do would be, first on program, to stop the flow of blood. Then he would clean off the limb and try to patch it up, and then I would be taught to use the limb and quite possibly associate with other people that had the same thing wrong with them that I had wrong with me. Some sort of rehabilitation to teach me how to use my leg again. So therefore, I can readily see now that regardless of where I went, until I stopped the flow of wine, it did no good, my friends, regardless of where I went. And I certainly tried many agencies before coming into here, and I won't say that I sincerely tried them. It was always in a very half-hearted way. I was afraid of them. I didn't believe what they were going to say anyway. Well, now, you know, this wonderful program of ours gives us an opportunity, as the big book says, to reveal what our stories are like, what we used to be like, and what we're like now. And for this, I like. Because, you know, if somebody else reveals what you used to be like and what you're like now, they dwell too much on what you used to be like. Everybody wants to tell what you used to be like all the time. And they either overdo it or underdo it all the time. Now, I remember a friend of mine coming to the building in which I now live, and the people in this building, they don't know me too well, thank heaven. And she was inquiring whether Mrs. Martin lived in this building or not, and I was leaning over the banister listening. And she says, one of the ladies on the first floor says, Mrs. Martin, no, I don't recall that name. And she said, the other lady that was down in front says, oh, do you mean the tall, quiet, dignified woman on the second floor? To which my friend replied, well, she is tall. So now you see those people, now they don't know whether I'm just tall or what. See, it's a mystery, and I, through the grace of God and His fellowship, I would like for it to be that way. See. Now when I tell you that I had my first blackout when I was 14 years of age, you're going to say, now just what kind of home did that person come from? What happened? Well, my dear friends, I came from a very, very strict religious home. It was strict in every sense of the word. My grandparents raised me. Now, when I tell you this, I don't tell it to you to cop a plea, because there were two other girls that were raised just exactly the way that I was raised. They were two cousins of mine, and they certainly are not alcoholics. But my grandfather, who raised us, being strict, that's beside the point. Anything we wanted to do was unlawful, illegal, unnecessary, or just too expensive. You didn't do anything, period. And There was one thing that was absolutely void in our home, and that was anything that had anything to do with affection. You could go to Alaska and come back and no one ever kiss you or anything like that. That was termed as vulgar. You just didn't do that. Now, I can remember my grandmother and grandfather sitting on one sitting on one side of the porch reading the Bible, and the other sitting on the other side of the porch reading the Bible. And how those two people ever had seven kids, I'll never know. I never saw them that close together. They just didn't happen. Affection was just simply null and void around our home. And naturally, that in my earliest beginning, I can remember that sort of left a little void within me, too. You would see other children, you know, parents would come and take them home from school and all that sort of thing. And naturally, I was the type of person who would have liked to have had a little of that. But now I cannot say that that made me become an alcoholic. It just simply made me become very belligerent. That's very true. Now, there was only one, what you might say, incidentally, I was born and raised in a very small town in Ohio. And it was one of those homes, communities rather, where if you do anything wrong, we talk about it. And if we do anything wrong, we hide it. Now, I had one uncle that was sort of an oddball. He was allowed the privilege of making home brew. That kept them so they thought it would keep him in the yard. But the more he made, the more he drank, and the more he went out of the yard. And he always came out at the most inopportune time. Now, I would see him from time to time. He was the only person who was allowed to have alcohol around there. From time to time, I would see him come home from work when he went to work. In the evening, and he had a big long dipper with this crock, and I would see him taste out of it and smack his lips and walk away, and it just seemed so very good that I tried that. Now, being a child, always feeling very inadequate, to begin with, I should tell you this, they always sort of looked upon me as being slightly retarded, too, you know. And I loved that part of it because I played right up to that. You know, you see, if you're retarded, you don't have to learn how to cook, wash dishes, or sew or anything. You know, you're retarded, you can't do that, you know. They bring anybody to the house, well, they introduce them to everybody. Well, this don't pay. She's odd, you don't pay attention. So I loved being retarded, see. Oh, really, you don't have to work. But getting back to this dear uncle of mine, I would see him come home and taste out of this wonderful beverage of his. And always feeling very inadequate, as I told you before, and very inferior. Now, I'd like to state here now, I never felt inferior because of my race or my color. I would have felt inferior of the wildest Mau Mau, but just one drink of this lovely concoction of my uncle's, and I could talk Mahatma Gandhi out of his safety pin. I felt wonderful after that. Wonderful. Everything was fine. But the most exasperating look I've ever saw on a man's face was one evening when he came home from work and he got out his bottle cappers and his bottle and everything, and he and I had tasted it all up. You know, one of those things where your car's going over the cliff? Well, that's the exact look he had on his face that day. But, you know, this alcohol seemed to give me that something, seemed to put the starch in my skirt or in my back that was sadly lacking. It seemed to, I never was a very good student in school anyway. I was one of them AM students, absent-minded, you know, I never paid much attention anyway. And I was the dreamer type. I like to sit and dream of candlelight and old wine. And my friends, I'd like to state here now that due to old wine, Edison thought I had all the candlelight that I needed a few years later, too, see. But nevertheless, this did seem to give me something. I could talk. I felt on equal terms with other people. I felt a little, shall I say, superior to anyone after that. Now, I can remember this first blackout that I had. I ran into three friends of mine that were quite a bit older than myself in Columbus, Ohio, about 45 miles from my home, and they were on their way there, and they had a bottle of moonshine, and that's exactly where I wound up at. Now, the next morning when I woke up, I do believe that's the first time in my life that I can remember experiencing remorse. Now, here I feel very remorseful for what I have done. I'm very sorry, see. On top of that, I would have liked to have gone home and said, I am sorry. But I'm too much of a coward to do that. Second on program, I know if I do it, I'm going to be rejected because my family didn't stand for that sort of thing. See? So next on program, there is fear. So we have remorse, we have cowardice, and we have fear. See? So when you have those three things, what else that's in is anger. Now I'm mad. Now who am I mad at? I'm mad at me because of all three of these things. So when we have those four things, there's only one thing left, and that is to become belligerent and get drunk again, and that's exactly what happened. So that is the mood that I went home in. Now, I won't go into any more of that part of my life, because to me, qualifying, I try to keep it as simple as I possibly can. There's no need to go beyond the bounds of propriety, shall I say, and that is what most of my drinking career would entail. But nevertheless, when I did get home, I found out that I wasn't too welcome. It wasn't many years later until I left home. Now, it started that sort of thing that most of us go through with. Wandering hither, thither, and yon. Always seeking something. Always looking for something. And it wasn't until I came into this fellowship that I found out what I was looking for. You see, to the body belongs emotion. To the soul, there's always hunger. And in this program, I have found out that these things are satisfied. To the intellect, we find the answer there, even here for that principle. And it wasn't until I came here that I found that. But it took me a great many years, my friends, because I could have qualified for this program when I was in my teens. I was ready for it when I was in my 20s. I was ripe when I was in my 30s. Let's leave it right there. I like it. But nevertheless, when we are, shall we say, fairly young and fairly decent looking, no one ever says you should not drink. At least they didn't say it to me. They simply say, darling, you shouldn't drink so much. And there is always the person, you know, it's always the old doll, you know, that takes the young dolls out, you know. To further her drinking career, you know, the old doll will take the young doll out, because no gentleman in his right mind is going to walk in a beer garden and buy the young doll a drink without buying the old doll a drink. See? Now, you see, the reason why I know this, I've played on both leagues, see. So that's the only way it works, see. But now they'll always tell you, darling, you shouldn't drink so much. Darling, now, you're too intelligent to drink so much. Well, now, if you wasn't intelligent, if you didn't drink, how are you going to show them how intelligent you are? And then here along will come the dear boys, and they'll say, now, darling, if you loved me, you wouldn't drink. Look, how in the world are you going to show a person how much you love them sober? Of course, you've got to be drunk. And then along will come someone else and say, now, darling, what you need in your life is companionship. And along will come your good parish priest, and they'll say, what you need in your life is religion. Well, I can remember one time I had two religions and somebody else's companion, and all three of them backfired, so that didn't work. It was just one of those things, you know. And then they'll say, you know, darling, what you should have in your life is a hobby. I tried that too. Now, darling, you know, you have a beautiful green thumb, see. Now, you should plant flowers. I can remember having a flower garden outside of my yard, and I can remember taking this wine bottle right out there with me, and one day horrible thing happened. I was down on my knees pulling weeds, and I kicked the thing over. And oh my gracious, it was a horrible catastrophe. So with the crude, cunning mind of an alcoholic, I just simply dug a hole in the ground and set the bottle down in there and stuck straws in there, and I could suck wine and pull weeds. And one day, to my amazement, I walked in my yard, and there was more straws sticking about the ground than was petunias. I planted bottles in the So it was one of those merry-go-rounds, see. Now, I'm one alcoholic that can always pat herself on the back and say, I never went to jail in my life. Oh, no, I always went right straight to the psychopathic ward. They didn't trust me in jail, that's for sure. But finally, one day, I did, you know, that loneliness that all alcoholics can have. I did try this great venture of matrimony that my friends had been telling me that I needed to do. And the man that I married, he was much sicker, or just as sick in his way as I was in mine. He was a confirmed gambler, and he was throwing it away faster than I could drink it up, and I couldn't stand that. And he really wasn't ready for the rigors of married life. He'd always led a very sheltered life. When he wasn't being sheltered in the House of Correction, he's been sheltered in Jackson Prison, see. So. But immediately, I knew nothing about AA at this particular time, but I immediately borrowed the fifth step and went right down to his draft board and admitted the exact nature of his wrong, see, and I got rid of him, see. Now, while he, shall we say, was being very well taken care of, my daughter was born to me. My son had already been born. Now, you see, ladies and gentlemen, I had the perfect setup for just exactly what I wanted to do, drink. But I had a good excuse now. You see, had I been married to Nelson Rockefeller, the
it would have been the same thing. You see, I wanted something bellyache about. I wanted people to feel sorry for me because I felt sorry for myself. I know many of you women used to hear that old soapbox opera, Poor Widow Martin and her two fatherless children to support. You haven't heard nothing you hear about Poor Widow. That was Poor Widow Brown, but you should have heard about Poor Widow Martin and her two fatherless children to support. I had a tearjerker. Oh, I could just tell you about how horrible everybody treated me. And here I had these two kids, and naturally I had to have two jobs. So I got a job, you know, working in the funeral establishment in the daytime, and oh my gracious, dead people are so horribly unfriendly. So I got a job working in beer garden at night to give me courage to go back to that undertaking parlor in the daytime. But you know, as time goes on, and we have told that this illness of ours gets more progressive as time does go by, and it certainly does. So you no longer work in the nice nightclubs; you begin to work in the dives and the dens, and then finally you become lookout woman for some of these gambling joints and that sort of thing. It's just one of those careers that goes down, down, down. Now, I suppose you're wondering, now, just how in the world, living like that, did you take care of your children? They must have been hungry or they must have been outdoors and all that sort of thing. No, my friends, that never happened. My children were always very well taken care of. That is, financially. They were always very well taken care of. They're always well fed and well dressed. You know why? Pride. I couldn't stand here today and tell you I love the responsibility. Oh, no, my friend. I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was pride, fear, guilt, remorse. You see, when you come stumbling in, drunk every day or every night, whichever the case may be, it's kind of hard to deny your kids anything. When people say you don't discipline your children, you say you don't discipline them because you love them. That isn't it. When you've got a hangover, you're not going to hit no kid and make him cry. You know that. You give him a quarter and send him to the show and get him out of the way. So therefore, they think it's love. But you know, and I know exactly what it is. Fear, guilt, and pride. And that was the way that they were raised. And believe you me, they thought I was the most wonderful mother in the world when they were small. For the very simple reason, I was the only woman on our block, say, that ran an account with the popsicle man, because they could go out and get anything they wanted, and I'll pay him Saturday when I come in. So my children were very happy. But you know, as time goes on, they're not too happy anymore. See, when they get a little bit older, no one likes to hear about how your mother performed at the PTA meeting. No one likes to hear that I saw your mother sleeping out under the tree last night, see, in your yard. When they come in and say, Mother, what happened at the PTA meeting? They were all laughing. They see, from time to time, I would try to straighten up, you know, and go to some of these things, but invariably, I would do or say the wrong thing. I can remember quite well one time when I was there. I had made a fool out of myself, as usual. I had tried to straighten up this particular day, and someone was going to have a bake sale for the school or something. I said, Mrs. Martin, will you bring a cake next week, or would you bake us a cake? I said, well, I'll buy you one. She says, but dear, we want you to make us one. Make a cake? Well, I never heard of such a thing. Well, Dolly, you should have been at Millie's last night. She passed out a wonderful recipe. Well, naturally, I'm very belligerent. Well, I passed out before I got to Millie's last night. That's what I don't know anything about it. So it was just that sort of thing, my friends, over and over. Now, all of this time, this problem of mine isn't getting any better. But I keep thinking, you know, our wonderful word procrastination, tomorrow I'm going to do something about it. Well, tomorrow, yes, I would do something about it. I would buy a different brand of wine or something like that, see, and get just as drunk and just as sick, and the same thing over and over and over. Now, finally, my appearance, just a little before coming into the program, had reached such astounding depths as this. Now, every female in the world likes to think she looks fairly presentable to a male, even if it's a female dinosaur, as far as that goes. But I was now wearing my son's blue jeans and a big floppy shirt, and having gone to bed with bubble gum in my hair, I gave myself a crew haircut. I can remember sitting in the beer garden this particular morning. I was at my all-time low, so I thought, and there were two gentlemen walking up and down the aisle looking. Now, there was only, I shouldn't call them gentlemen after the remarks they made about me. Other than these two gentlemen and the bartender and myself, I just got my kids off to school, and they were walking up and down the aisle, and do you know what they were trying to decide, whether I was a man or a woman?
They came to that deduction this way. They said, oh, that's a woman. And the other says, how do you know? He says, there's too much hanging over the stool to be a man. Now, I left out of there with the greatest intentions. Now, I'm going to do something about this. But now, on the way home, naturally, I've got to stop by my bootlegger's house and consult Harry. Well, Harry says, now, babe, you don't look so bad. You look just as good as anybody else. And pretty soon, Mary comes by, who's a friend of mine, and she, Harry's giving me a drink. Mary buys me a drink, and I've got two drinks. And then somebody else by, well, first thing you know, I look better than Harry or Mary, either one. So I'm going right back to the beer garden and tell them about it, you know? Well, that's what happened. About a week before I came into this fellowship, well, I'll say it was 3 weeks. My friends, if you have ever seen a zombie, that is exactly what had happened to me. That treacherous wine. Cunning, baffling, and powerful, just exactly what the big book tells us that it is. It is indeed those things, my friends. Please believe me. I can remember 3 weeks prior to coming into this program, I had become like a zombie. But 6 or 7 years prior to my coming into this program, I remember sitting one Saturday evening in my kitchen with the radio on. And over the radio, there came a story called The Glass Crutch. I don't remember any of the incidents of this story. All I know, it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. And it said, if you ever need our help, we'll be the first number in the book. Well, I thought to myself, if that dame would just quit drinking whiskey and drink wine, she wouldn't need those people, whatever they are, see. But you know, Almighty God, in spite of all of his greatness, he is still a gentleman. He does not go where he is not wanted. But do you know, he's a very subtle gentleman. I can remember walking down the street, this story would come back to my mind, say it possibly once a year, and then twice a year, and then maybe every 3 months, so 6 or 7 years prior to my coming in here. And walking down the street, I can remember the heel plates beating out on the pavement, the glass crutch. I can remember sitting in the kitchen and the clock on the wall, it didn't say tick-tock, it said the glass crutch. I remember sitting one evening in my living room holding a glass of something, and you can believe me, it was alcohol, reading a newspaper, and it seemed like every word on that newspaper read the glass crutch. And it wasn't until then that my eyes left the words and fell on my hand that I knew exactly what those words meant, the glass crutch. I said to myself, Holly Martin, you can't even read a newspaper without a drink in your hand. Now, I would like to tell you that there and then I dropped the glass and ran madly to the phone, but I did no such thing. I said, I can lick this myself. I am the one that's getting drunk. I am the one that is getting in trouble. I am the one that's getting sick, and I am the one that can do it. So 6 or 7 years passed, and I was the one that continued to get drunk, continued to get sick, continued to get in trouble. Well, you know, I think all of us have felt that feeling of rejection at some time or other in our lives, and I had felt it about all of mine, and I certainly had incurred it with my people and everyone else, and I was now beginning to do the same thing in the neighborhood with my neighbors. But the last 3 weeks, as I started to tell you about, if I drank, I could not get drunk. If I didn't drink, I couldn't get sober. You are strictly hooked then. I think I had the fragments of just exactly one brain left. I thought about calling that number this particular day when the washing machine was sitting in the floor talking and the refrigerator and the stove, but that was standard equipment. I was used to them talking, so that meant nothing. So I devised in this crude, cunning mind of mine that I'll tell them down there I got a friend. So I go to the phone and I call the number. I said, I got a friend out here. I said, I think she's losing her mind. I said, wish you'd come and get her. So with my tongue about that thick, the lady said, would you like to have someone talk with you? I said, oh, no, goodbye. Not me. My friend, I told you. But 24 hours later, I'm sitting in the same chair. And I had to make that call. I had to do it. So the lady told me she would send someone out to see me. Alcohol again, cunning, baffling, and powerful. I'd been like a zombie all of this time, but 45 minutes or a half an hour before the people came to take me to my first meeting,
Two lush buddies of mine came by there and gave me two drinks, and I got just as drunk as I've ever been in my life. It was the same as pouring coal oil on hot coals. The very time when I didn't want to be drunk, I got drunk. Cunning, baffling, and powerful, just that. Well, I don't remember too much about that first meeting that I attended. But I do know this. The next morning, here's what caused me to go to my second meeting. These words. Rarely have we ever seen it fail. When I woke up the next morning, those words came to my mind, and I went back, ladies and gentlemen, just for that reason. What are you drinking that doesn't get you into all the things that I get into? That's why I went back. See, I wanted to know how could I make my neighbors' lives more manageable. See, how could I make my priest treat me different? How could I make my kids behave? You know, now you must be drinking something, you know, that might would give me a very, you know, beautiful personality. See, that I could, you know, influence them and win their friendship back or something like that. But stop drinking. Oh, no, that never entered the picture. I was, you know, you probably had something else that's new on the market that I hadn't been able to get hold of or something. Or maybe some pill I could take. Let's don't talk about pills. That's all we hear nowadays. But nevertheless, when I went back to my second meeting, that's why I would like to always impress upon the new person. If there is a question that you want to ask, don't ever feel, oh, this is too stupid to ask. Because, my friends, if they'd have said, keep it stupid, I'd have got it the first night, but they said, keep it simple, see. Because I asked them all the most stupid question in the world. I said, do you mean to tell me if I keep coming back here, all those little things that's running around the house will go away? And one of the gentlemen said she must have had DTs, and others said, oh, no, probably just hallucinations. I said, look, gentlemen, I'm paying rent for something besides me and the kids. I wished it would go away to keep coming back. Well, you know, I was still a very good follower because there was nothing else left for me to do. Now, they would hand me a book, see. Nobody got down on their knees and begged me, see. But they handed me a book, and they said, now, Holly, after taking me around a week or two, on Monday night you go here, on Tuesday night you go there, on Wednesday night you go there. And every time I'd open my mouth, they'd give me, I was scared to death of them, you know. They'd give me one of them looks, you know. And I go, oh, dear, see. At last, here's something, you know, I've got friends. I've got people at least who'll tell me where to go, and it isn't that warm place either, you know. So, you know, I would go, but it was a long time before I could open my mouth to say a word. But they've never been able to shut me up, though, once I started. Well, you know, finally. After doing the things that I was told to do, I mean doing exactly what I was told to do. And everything, because see, I couldn't do anything else, I didn't have sense enough to think, see, so I had to do exactly what I was told to do. Finally, one day, when I was reading chapter 5, and when I got to the end of it there, or the beginning of it rather, or wherever it is, there's one word that struck my fancy. And that was the word that won me and captivated me. What word was that? The very first word of the 12th step. We. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you, you'll never know when I sat there that day and I thought I had been around the program almost a year. I had never taken a drink. But I was still very dense. That word we hit me for just exactly what it is worth. We. It meant to me unity, friendship, and fellowship, that I was no longer alone. You know, my friends, loneliness has caused more mischief than poverty ever dreamed of. It meant that I was no longer that woman down the street with them two damn bad kids. I was accepted back into the human race. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. It wasn't that Holly Martin had to admit it all by herself. We. And there's many times when I walk into our meeting place and I see people coming through the door, I think of that word we. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Then we begin to have something to hold on to. You see, at first the new person doesn't have too much faith in a God. He has to put his faith first. And what the activity that he sees about him until he can be able to begin to think again. Well, in that first phase of our program where we have gained our sobriety through this word we, then it begins to unfold for us. But we never say I. Because you remember, my friends, the one time in my life that I start taking credit, that I got sober, I'm on my way out. Because I'll be just like Peter when he walked on the water. As long as he kept his eyes on the master, he walked. But the minute he started looking at his feet, he began to flounder. And my friends, that would be the same way with me in here today when I start taking credit that I got sober after 27 years of being drunk. I got sober. Oh no. With the, by the grace of Almighty God and the help of the people in AA, I was able to obtain sobriety. You know, it is a very wonderful thing. So therefore, we want to hold on to it. So we begin what happens. The big book says, remember you deal with alcohol, cunning, battling, and powerful. Without help, it's too much for you. But there's one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Almighty God himself says, without me you can do nothing. So, ladies and gentlemen, I came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. Sanity, my friends. This kind of sanity. The sanity to say this to myself each and every day. Any time, any person, place, or thing becomes so important that I must take a drink, then that person, place, or thing is just simply too important to me. I cannot afford it. You see, no one must be that important to me that I must take a drink because of them. See? Sanity, that second step to me, they told me in the beginning, Holly, you too will find the key that will open this program for you, that will open the door. And it was in that second step that I came to believe in this power that could restore me to sanity. You know, in the second step, when we speak of sanity, we begin to think of something else. A lot of times when we first come into the program, we hear people say, you know, if I could just get my wife back, if I could just get me a little money in the bank, or if I could just get this or that, you know, I could handle this deal of staying sober. I could handle that. Sometimes those things are restored to us. And along the same time is restored that old ego. And then what happens? Well, I got my wife back and I got my job back and everything's going along nice. You know, I see. So why shouldn't I celebrate these things? And by the same token, the practicing alcoholic, he knows that one way to celebrate anything, and that's to get drunk. So then he forgets this power, God as I call him, that he's prayed to. He forgets this fellowship because I have got this power. Then he begins to put a whole lot of confidence in these things. That becomes a power to him. Carl Thompson that wrote The Hound of Heaven, all things betrayeth thee who betrayeth me. My friends, I never want to forget that. But these things become so important to me. So you see, my friends, it's very necessary that there's a part of my life. All of my life must belong in this program, it's true, 24 hours at a time. But now I'm offered something that I have never recognized before, a divine partnership. To make a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand him. That, my friends, is another thing that makes this program wonderful. God as you understand him. Not the God that my grandfather tried to cram down my throat. Not the God that anybody else wanted to cram down my throat. To me, when I think of that third step, my friends, it goes one step further than the greatest love story that was ever told, the story of Ruth and Naomi. Because when I'm with my people, as you are, I feel that story. Whither thou goest, I shall go. Whither thou lodgest, I shall lodge. Thy people shall be my people. But you go a step further. You don't say thy God shall be my God. It's God as I understand it. It makes no difference whether it's a Protestant with his voice raised in song. It makes no difference whether it's a Jew violently going in and out of his synagogue, or whether it's the Catholic on bended knee, receiving the Holy Eucharist with anointed hands of the priest, if God is he, understand him, and in here no one else tries to cram any other kind of God down your throat. That is why I do believe, for me, it was such a privilege to enter into that partnership, a divine partnership. How important is it that I associate with people of that nature? I'll tell you how important it is. To me, it is very important. When I sat with my fellow men and hear them say, I believe and I have made a decision. How would you feel today or tomorrow if you walked into a hospital and you were ready for a serious operation and the doctor would say to you, now I'm going to do all that I can for you and we will trust in God. I'm sure whatever the anesthetic was, you could go off very peacefully to sleep. But now supposing on the other hand the doctor would say this, now look, you got to have this operation and if this knife fails, bud, that's it. You know what you're going to say? Doc, give me my hat. That's exactly what you're going to say. So my friends, up to me, that's why it is so very important that I try my best each and every day when I make this decision to turn my life and my will over to him, that I try to help others to think along those same lines if I possibly can. You see, that third step does something else to me. Made a decision. It gives me freedom. Decision each day to discipline me. You know, we get tired of other people disciplining us all the time. But it gives me the decision to discipline myself, to say to myself, my conduct today is more important than my plans are for tomorrow. I can make that decision through his help this day. So therefore, when we have got our sanity and our sobriety, we want to keep those two things. So we go a step further, looking for something else to hold on to those things. Just what, my friends, is that step? We call it in here serenity. You can call it peace, serenity, or whatever you want to call it. What is peace? Well, I think St. Augustine told us what it was. Peace is a tranquility of order. And that's what we want in our lives. So therefore, I go way back in that fourth step where I made a searching and fearless moral inventory to something I learned as a child, but it went in one ear and out the other. And what was that? Avoid the near occasion of sin. Well, I forgot all about that many years ago. But I've learned how to apply it in that fourth step. Avoid the near occasion of that first drink. And there's only one way that I can avoid the near occasion of that first drink, and that is to make a searching and fearless moral inventory. And what is two of the greatest words in that fourth step? Of ourselves. Because, you see, you don't need to worry about it, or that somebody else is not doing it for you, because the minute you walk through the door, somebody says, $1.05, you ain't gonna make it no how, see. You know, they got you faded, see. So you make a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself, see. And sometimes I like to go a little further and take a searching and fearless physical inventory of myself. You know, sometimes after we've been around here a day or two, you know, and your corns don't hurt you and your lumbago's not bothering you, you know, you begin to feel pretty good, and you begin to look at yourself, and you say, oh, I believe I could go back down there, you know, and all the boys and girls would just be tickled to death to see me, and I wouldn't have to spend a dime while everybody would just love me so, and I could just get drunk as I please. Well, remember, my friends, the drier the hay, the quicker it burns. So each day, sometimes when I get that thought, too, I'm looking pretty fair. Well, I'll pass on to you a little antidote that works beautifully for me in making this searching and fearless physical inventory. Some mornings when you first get up out of bed and you have that divine feeling of your own wonderful appearance, after you have removed your night clothes, leave your teeth laying on the dresser, now put your eyeglasses on, stand back and look at yourself. And you know, my friends, we are not the downy ones and feet of bears that we once thought we were. You know how pretty we thought we were in the bar? No, my friends, we're not, see. You know, it kind of calms that ego down. You know, you won't be so busy running back around the meeting. You know how it is, sometimes you'll hear this Now, darling, just lean on me. I'll show you the way. Some poor old codger, you know. Just lean on me. I'll show you the way. And his wife and kids is home leaning on the welfare, and he's looking for some darn doll to lean on him. See? Know thyself. And on the other hand, here's some dear old dame. Oh, I just want to mother you, dear. You just want to dominate somebody. You don't want to mother nobody. Know thyself. You know, that'll cut down all that ego when we take this inventory. I find that the head of the list in my inventory, my friends, is pride. Pride. That awful thing, that grandfather of all character defects, pride. Pride, what caused the first murder in the world? Pride. Because pride certainly can bring on anger and every other resentment. When Abel, when Cain slew his brother, why? Through anger. What caused the anger? Pride. Because his brother's gift was more acceptable than his. And he got angry. If pride can cause the first murder that was ever committed in the world, when the world was still fresh from the hands of Almighty God, what can it do to a lowly alcoholic like me? And that must constantly be my prayer, Almighty God, remove this pride. Humbly ask him to remove this awful pride. You know, sometimes when we say in this step, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, that one word sticks out, entirely ready. It doesn't say willing, it says ready. See, that works like a dose of castor oil. Being willing isn't enough, you got to be ready, you know, one of those things. See. And you know, sometimes we'll say to ourselves, well, you know, I've got just this one little thing I've got to hold on to. I can't give that up. Remember about the rich young man that went to the master and said, Master, what can I do to be saved? And the master said, sell all that you have and give it to the poor. And the young man went away sorrowful. In our case, when we say, I can give up everything but this, I can't give up that, that's why many of us go away drunk. We can't give up that one little thing, see. You know, sometimes I've had to say that to myself, my friend. I can't give up this. I'm a human being. And then I say, well, Holly Martin, if you're a human being, quit living like a dog then. You know, that'll take care of itself. So we become entirely ready. And then again, you might hear a person say, well, you know, the thing of it is, you know, I'm having a little trouble. You know, the reason I'm having a little trouble, because, see, I just simply can't get that spiritual part. He or she, sometimes, you know, how we want to evade that, because along with sanity, there comes responsibility. So then we'll say, oh, I don't want to be too sane or have too many responsibilities, see. So, after all, I said to a friend of mine last week who was on a drinking bout, I said, is there any reason in your mind why you would like to go insane? And he said, yes, I don't want to face responsibilities. The most honest thing ever insane in my life, see. And how true it is. But you know, that doesn't mean that the way I look at it in my inventory for me, when I speak of the spiritual part of the program, and when I'm speaking of an inventory, that I must get down and become a holy roller, doesn't mean that at all. Because the Master has said, just faith, size of mustard seed. To me, it's just like Braille cream, friends. A little dab will do you. You know what I mean? If you, but be sure you got that dab, though, see. It'll do it. And hold on to it, regardless of how small it is. Hold on to it, it will grow. It will grow. So now when we have these wonderful things, our sanity, our sobriety, and our peace of mind, you know, my friends, we begin to think, now there's many things that I have done, I would like to make amends for them. And it tells us in this wonderful program of ours that we make direct amends. That one word there, direct amends. How many times do we like to be evasive about that? Oh, well, you know, I went to church this morning, you know. Now, he's walking around the meeting. He's not speaking to John, Joe, or Harry. He don't like them. He can't talk to them. He's mad. But, you know, I went to church today, and I lit a candle. And I said a few prayers. Step didn't say that. Said made direct amends. I don't care if you set the whole church on fire. It says it made direct amends. See, Almighty God said this. Make peace with your brother and then bring your gift to the altar. See? So, ladies and gentlemen, I must do it. There's a logical side of it, and there's a spiritual side of it. And to me, they are so closely interwoven that I don't want to separate them, and I couldn't if I tried. So I must be little enough to be big enough to make direct amends. Sometimes, my friends, these things can hit us awfully hard. Sometimes, you know, the people that we try to make amends to can slap us in the face the hardest. It doesn't say when. It just says exact. But it doesn't say when that I must do it. For me, I waited until I was strong enough where if I was rejected, I knew that I had you people to turn to, and I knew that I had God as I understand him to turn to. I knew that. Down in the fifth step, which I find to me is so very important, that fifth step. That too, my friends, is so very necessary for me to help the new man or new woman when they're coming in, that I admit to God and one other person the exact nature of my wrongs, and I will tell you why that it's so necessary that I must take it. There is a story that is told to me of a young man that lived in Mexico, and he was a very outstanding young man, very young and very handsome and very well thought of in his neighborhood. And one day, through a fit of anger, he killed a friend of his, and he hid his friend in the bushes. And his friend, the spirit of his friend, came back to him, and he said to him, "Why don't you go and confess your guilt so that you might be able to help other people in the same situation?" He said, "Oh, no, I can't do that. Try it again, my friends. I simply can't do that." So he said to the spirit, "I tell you what you do. You may punish me in any way that you feel like doing it. Just don't make me confess it." So the spirit of the man says, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. For the rest of your life, carry me around on your back. No one will know that I'm there but you, because I will be invisible. Only you will know that I'm there." The young man readily agreed because of his wonderful reputation, you know, and his self-esteem. But as time went on, as he was carrying the spirit of this man around on his back, his townspeople noticed that he became more bent over. He became more irritable. He got angry at the slightest provocation. He took exception to the slightest thing. And they wondered, what is happening to him? He used to be so upright, such a kind person. Well, you know, these bones were growing heavier and heavier and heavier. No one could see them, not even himself, but he could feel them. So finally, one day, the bones of this spirit grew so heavy and the stench so great that he ran to the proper authorities and admitted his guilt. You know, my friends, in order to help the new man or woman that's coming through that door, I must get rid of this bag of bones that rattles. See? Because your bones and my bones rattling makes too much commotion, you know? So I must rid myself first, see? Pick bolt out of my own eye first. That is how, my friends, I have thought that I must work that. Now, when I have these things that I must meditate on each and every day, and I must think how I can improve on them, what do I do? I come down to the tenth step. Well, I continue to take a personal inventory. And for once, I'm told to do something right away. Promptly admit when I'm wrong. Why must I promptly admit when I'm wrong? You never told me to be in a hurry about anything before. I'll tell you why. I think so. For me. This old attic that had all the filth in it, all the unnecessary junk. In there somewhere there was a greasy rag, and the door was closed on it. And there must have been matches and gasoline and everything else, because we had spontaneous combustion. It flew open. That's when I got drunk, you know. So I find that it's very necessary for me to promptly, once I get this old attic or closet cleaned out, promptly keep it cleaned out. Each and every day, continue to take an inventory. Continue to take an inventory for continued sobriety, continued peace of mind. What must I watch out for? Complacency. You know how we begin to think? Oh, I've been sober 14, 15 years, 6, 7 years. I'm still sober. Well, I'm so-and-so do such and such a thing. I don't see why I should do it. I'm sober, yes. Remember the story, my friends, of when the good master was going through a small village and he was hungry. And he saw a beautiful green fig tree that had beautiful
beautiful leaves, but it bore no fruit, and he cursed that tree. Complacency, my friend. It bore no fruit. The master today is still hungry for the sick alcoholic that's out there. Let's watch that complacency. Holly must watch that complacency. Then again, you know, another thing that we can come up with when we don't watch that. Well, you know, I would do thus and so forth around the phone, but you know, I don't know how. I would chair the meeting, but I don't know how. You know, a man never knows how far he can cast his shadow till he stands up. You must stand up first. Action is the magic word. Well, you know, I don't want to do too much because I might be criticized. Oh, you don't want to be criticized. Well, my friend, again we are told, let your light shine in order that men might see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. But do you remember what it says? That men might see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. It didn't say a thing in there about Holly Martin, did it? No. That they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. So whatever I do, it is for his glory. I have none. I destroyed mine. I never had any. I'll never have any. See? So therefore, when people say, I don't want to be criticized, remember what you're doing. You're doing it, yes, to further your sobriety, but you really are doing it for him in an act of gratitude. And you know, sometimes when we forget these things, the next thing we see is John and Mary walking down the street, you know, and they're kind of wobbling, their eyes kind of red, and they want to tell you, well, you know, I don't know how it happened, but that old compulsion set in. What old compulsion? You mean, my friends, that old dishonesty set in? You see, there can be no compulsion without first consent of the will. And if each and every day I'm taking that third step, that I made the decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God, well, then it's in his hands, and I have no reason to use that which is not mine for my purpose. So then I've told a lie again, haven't I? That old compulsion set in. Oh, no. There's no compulsion without first consent of the will to take that first drink, my friend. I must always realize that too first myself. And then there comes that tranquil period in our lives, that beautiful 11th step, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. How do I work that step? Let me tell you a little story. Each day when the shepherd takes his sheep out to graze them, he watches over them, and when he brings them home in the evening, as they come through the gate, the old shepherd stands there with his crook in his hand, and if he notices the least thing wrong with the sheep, he touches them on the neck or on the head, meaning for that sheep to step out of line so that he might administer to whatever ailments the sheep might have, whether it's something in his ear or eye or his foot or whatever it is. Then these sheep that have stepped aside, he administers to them, and the next day, as he sits watching his flock, each one of these sheep in return will come up to him and lay their face beside of him to show the shepherd how much they appreciate him taking care of them. Is it necessary for me to seek through prayer and meditation? I, who have been endowed in the likeness of Almighty God, and certainly endowed with more intelligence than a human, than an animal, shouldn't I take time out to acknowledge what my shepherd has done for me? Many times we say, well, prayer and meditation with all the trouble I got. We pray when it's hard to pray. With all the trouble I got, that's the first thing we'll think of. Man's adversity is God's opportunity. Many times these things that have happened to me, naturally being a human being, and a very frail one, I would wonder, But I must realize that that too is the touch of the shepherd's crook when adversity besets me. You know, the story is told of a rabbi going through a town, and he only had three possessions: a donkey, a lantern, and a rooster. And that's all he had in the world. But there was a band of soldiers out looking for him to kill him, and he hid in the forest. He said, "Well, I'll light this lantern to give so I can see." And the wind blew the lantern out. He said, "Everything God does for the best. God be blessed." When he nodded off to sleep that night, a wild animal ate up his donkey and his rooster. The next day when he woke up, the tracks of the soldiers had just passed right by him. Had the wind not blown out the lantern, they would have seen the light and killed him. Had the donkey lived, he would have brayed. Had the rooster lived, he would have crowed, and they would have found him. So sometimes when the last of our possessions are gone, God does what's best. God be blessed. So you know, my friends, that's why that 11th step to me is so important. And it's important for another reason. There's something else very important that I must do. And that, my friends, brings me down to the last step, where I'm told in here that I must practice these principles in all my affairs. After having had a spiritual awakening, I practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, we call it sponsorship. But to me, my friends, it's stewardship. Because I realize that that has been entrusted to my hands. And one of these days, Almighty God will say to me, "Holly Martin, how did you handle the stewardship that I entrusted to you? How did you treat that new person when they came through the door? Did you get off in a little click over here and yakety yakety yak? Didn't you have time to go to that door and stretch out your hand? Is it the things that you said that made that person turn and walk away?" The pen, we are told, is more mightier than the sword, but the tongue is the most destructive of all three. Is it that I didn't want to go down there and sponsor that person because they didn't come up to my social level? Or I didn't want her to sit beside of me because she used to be a prostitute? Or she used to do this or that and I don't want her around me? My friends, Mary Magdalene followed Almighty God all the way to Calvary for her sins. Just how far are you willing to follow him for your sobriety? And it certainly is by helping the new person that we obtain and maintain it. How often do I attend meetings, or was there something on the radio that I, on the television that I just had to see? When I walk through that door, I'm showing my gratitude. We're just like the lepers. Or we can be, that Almighty God cleansed. When only one went back to thank him, and he said, "Did I not cleanse 10? Where are the other 9? Don't you sometimes feel that way when you walk into your meeting place and you meet Mary or Joe or Harry and you wonder, "Where are the other 9? Lord, I don't want to be one of the other 9 that forgot to be grateful." Practice these principles in all of our affairs, yes, my friends. We're told that that is a big order. But the big book tells us, do not be discouraged. None of us has ever been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. So when you feel that low, depressed discouragement, come back so that you might taste victory through defeat. Regardless of how many slips you've had, keep coming back. You say, "Well, I have failed so many times." Remember, my friend, the greatest life that ever lived stumbled 3 times under the weight of his cross. But he stumbled on to Calvary so that we could be here this afternoon. My friend, you too, keep trying. Keep asking, keep believing. And someday, when you feel the power of His hand guiding your life, you too will cry out with the same awe and ecstasy of St. Thomas, "My Lord and my God," because you too have come to believe. Thank you.